Hi, and welcome to the Newbery Chronicles. This is a podcast where two people read through every Newbery medal-winning book, and then we talk about it. I'm Michael.
And I'm Rebecca.
And at long last, we're bringing you our hotly anticipated follow-up to our 90s episode way back in October. It's a new year. It's a new day for this podcast. And hopefully, this new year will bring more frequent episodes, but we make no promises. Because
Rebecca makes no promises.
It's been so long since we did our last podcast that I forgot if we even promised to be more frequent last time. So I'm not making any New Year's resolutions.
I never do.
None. I resolve to not make any resolutions. But anyway, this time we are talking about the 2005 Newbery Medal winning book, Kira Kira by Cynthia Katahata. And yeah, so in a little bit we'll talk about that. But first, it's been 2 months. We've read a few things in the intervening chasm of time. Rebecca, what have you read since our last episode?
I'm not going to talk about all of these because it's too long and nobody cares. But I will briefly expound upon this. So I finished reading Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier, which is a reread for me, and I reread it because Michael and a friend of ours, I think you talked about this last podcast, are reading this together at a little book club, and I will say I loved it more the second time. It's one of those that I think really, the more times you read it, the more times you catch things because you already know what's going to happen, so you can pay more attention to those things in the beginning. Another thing that was different for me this time around was that I read it physically instead of listening to it. And in general, I always read things more closely when I'm physically reading them than when I'm listening to them and doing 20 other things. So it's just a great book. I also had the opportunity to read a short story collection of hers this year that I talked about in a former episode. And I just think she's superb. And she was very prolific, so I really want to read more of her stuff this year. I read The Pairing by Casey McQuiston, which I cannot talk about on this podcast. I read, but it was very good. I read All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Dower. I guess that's how you say his name. I'm not really sure. Which is a book that is set in a Nazi-occupied Paris. And it follows the story of this young girl in Paris who is hiding a very, very special jewel from the Nazis. There's a whole story behind that that I'm not going to give away. But basically, her father has been entrusted with this jewel so that it is not taken by the Nazis. And then it follows the parallel journey of a young orphan boy who ends up becoming a Nazi soldier, and their paths cross, and it's just about their story together. It's a very beautiful story. There's a Netflix series that's been made out of this that I really want my in-laws to read this book so that we can then watch the series together because I think they would really like it, but it was a great story. I read Go Tell It on the Mountain by James Baldwin, which is a beautiful story filled with very beautiful prose. It's also, to me, it was very dark. And I wasn't sure how much of it was supposed to be dark or how much of it I was reading into that. It's a very religious text that follows, and it's also semi-autobiographical of James Baldwin's childhood. So it's a very beautiful book. It was also very dark. And the weather was also changing at the time, so it was probably not a great time for me to read it because everything felt very heavy and depressing. But it's a beautiful book. I reread Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, which was a very beautiful journey because I read it. I mentioned this also in the podcast, but I read it while I was listening to a podcast about Louisa May Alcott's life and about a chapter-by-chapter review of Little Women from a queer literary criticism lens. And that story is just so beautiful, and it's been so important to me since I was a child. So being able to read it again through this new lens was a really, it was truly a gift, and I really, really enjoyed it. And I have a newfound respect for Louisa May Alcott and all of her work. and just new perspective into her life. What the terminology didn't exist at the time, but a lot of Louisa's writings indicate, and like scholarly, what is the word I'm looking for? Scholarly work indicates that Louisa was probably a trans man. And so just reading this book with that perspective was a really beautiful gift. I read The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store by James McBride, which I think won like the Barnes & Noble Book of the Year last year or something like that. And that was a truly beautiful story that kind of like parallels the lives of Jewish people and African-American people in this one small town, and really explores a lot about class and race, and is also a very interesting plot. I'm not going to go into it because it's very complicated. It's been a long time since I read it. That book was really, really good. And then I also read Killers of the Flower Moon by David Gran, which was also very good. It was a nonfiction book about the murders of the Osage people and how the FBI was founded, what kind of like came to what it to a more respected like form of government through the investigation of these murders. And it was very, very sad and very enlightening about the experiences of these particular Indigenous people, and also just really enlightening about how much you justify things when you decide that people are less than you. Anyway, it was a very, like, I think David Gran's writing is very engaging and interesting, and it never gets boring, even though it's really a book of nonfiction about a historical event, but like the characters take on this really vibrant life. And I tried to watch the movie on a plane recently, and it was too much for me to see on the screen, but the book was really good. So that's what I read.
What you justify when you view people as less than you.
Mm-hmm.
It's too bad the FBI didn't learn that lesson a little bit.
I do think the book is also very, it's also very critical of the FBI, while it's also talking about this investigator who was an agent for the FBI. Like, it's pretty damning of J. Edgar Hoover overall. So I think that it's worth your time.
If there is a version of FBI history that is not damning of J. Edgar, I'm not interested. Anyway, here's what I read. I read fewer things, per usual. But I don't even remember what I said I was reading in the last podcast. I finished Vineland by Thomas Pynchon. That was pretty good. No Gravity's Rainbow, but I wasn't really expecting it to be. I also read probably the only, I think the only 2024 published book. Like the only book I read published in 2024, which is called Say Hello to My Little Friend, which is by Janine Capo-Cruzet. It's about these dudes in Miami, with this one dude in particular who decides he's a pit bull impersonator. That's kind of like his hobby slash like how he earns like his side hustle, I guess you could say. But he gets a cease and desist letter from the real pit bull, and so he's like, well, what am I gonna do now? And he thinks about the movie Scarface, the remake starring Al Pacino, and thinks, I just want to follow Scarface's trajectory, you know, and become this big, wealthy dude in Miami. And so, like, this guy is, like, 19 or something like that in the book. And so there's a lot of, like, dramatic irony and distance from it, where we are kind of meant to, like, laugh at him for being kind of young and dumb. But also, the book is about Miami and, like, about how it's been portrayed in media and how that shaped people's perceptions of the real Miami, and how those perceptions kind of like replicate themselves in the people in Miami, and then don't like, and the ways that they don't actually match up with like the people in Miami that are living there. Specifically, it's like most of the characters in this book are like Cuban. So it's like the Cubano population in Miami. It's specifically that subculture. And of course, Scarface also focuses on that same community, But also, a kind of parallel thing is the second point of view character that we have in this book is this killer whale that's in basically SeaWorld. It's not called SeaWorld, but it's basically SeaWorld. And so there's this, like, killer whale that's, like, imprisoned or, you know, domesticated in whatever you want to call it. The book pretty clearly portrays it as, like, an imprisonment. And so we are, like, in the mind of this, like, killer whale as, like, a kind of parallel. And there's, like, parallel, like, metaphors going on about, like, how, like, Cuban, you know, young Cuban children in Florida as opposed to, you know, being in Cuba, you know, in the same way that, like, this killer whale has been, like, captured out of the ocean and put into Miami. And there's other things, too. There's kind of, like, an ongoing mystery about, like, people keep alluding to the protagonist's mother, not the killer whale, but the guy, the protagonist's mother, and, you know, some sort of secret with her that had to do with his crossing from Cuba to the United States. And, you know, you eventually learn about that. Eventually, the whale, like, the killer whale and the guy, like, get, like, almost like a psychic connection where this killer whale is able to, like, project things into his mind. So there's, like, an element of this book that is, like, you know, very kind of, like, fantastical. And also, like, the narrator is really kind of, like, this distant kind of bemused narrator that makes the book really flexible. So there's, like, chapters that are more just, like, just commentary on Miami or, like, other chapters that are, like, sarcastically talking about things that have already happened in the book. I thought it was really engaging. The place where it ends up is somewhere where I'm not sure exactly what's supposed to be going on. It's got kind of a, like, a brutal, dark ending that, I don't know. I'm not going to say the book lost me, but I need to think more about what that is meant to be. Another book that I read, speaking of dark, and Rebecca's talked about this book on the podcast, is this book called James by Percival Everett, which is, like, a retelling of Huckleberry Finn, the Mark Twain novel, but through the perspective of Jim, the, like, runaway slave. And I thought this was good. I was a little thrown initially that it's not actually following the events of Huckleberry Finn in a super dedicated fashion. It's more of, like, taking the ingredients of Huckleberry Finn and remixing them in a way that, like, foregrounds Jim the character, who's been kind of remade into this, like, almost, like, a Candide-like figure, because he's like, been able to educate himself in his enslaver's library. He, like, sneaks in, and so, like, there's this device in the book where, like, the black characters, when there's not white people around, will talk with, like, completely, like, sounds like they're, like, educated white people. Right, like, you know, in terms of, like, the dialect being used, or, like, they use standard English, I guess, is probably the better way of saying it. But then, like, the kind of, like, you know, heavily dialect, you know, whatever that we see in, like, the Huckleberry Finn dialogue is, like, a kind of, like, an act that James and the other black characters put on. Anyway, I thought this was really good. I was a little bit distracted, like I said, about, like, trying to piece together, like, how is this supposed to fit with the Huckleberry Finn novel? There's, like, some plot twists later on that, again, like, I'm not sure what they, like, mean in the context of, like, adapting Huckleberry Finn. They are interesting and cool in the context of the novel. I guess I would say, like, if you're looking at this book and are, like, really familiar with Huckleberry Finn already, don't look at it as, like, necessarily direct. It's not meant to be, like, the same book from a different perspective, right? It's meant to be, like, almost like treating Huckleberry Finn like myth. And so this is, like, another way to engage with, like, the kind of mythic past that Huckleberry Finn engages with. Because Huckleberry Finn was written, like, decades after it takes place as well. And is, in a way, mythologizing a kind of past that Mark Twain, you know, from a certain perspective that Mark Twain is trying to present. And I think that this book is doing kind of the same. But it's good. Definitely worth reading. The last book that I read that I'll talk about is just kind of, it was kind of like a breezy nonfiction book. So there's this series of books called Boss Fight, which is basically like each one is a game developer talking about some famous game of theirs. I read this one about the game Spelunky, which is just a kind of silly but really fun game that I've played for like many years now at this point. But you know, it's like if you're into games, it's a roguelike mixed with a platformer. So you have randomly generated levels, and you're trying to descend deeper and deeper into these ruins to get treasure and stuff. Anyway, this book is written by its creator, Derek Yu. And so he kind of like talks through like the whole like development process of Spelunky, where he got his ideas, how people reacted to some of these ideas, and the way that it was initially like a free game online that you could just download, and then eventually how he went through the process of making a expanded version for the Xbox Live Arcade. It's interesting if you've played the game. It basically has nothing to offer you if you haven't played the game. I thought it was fun. It was just a fun way, breezy way for me to end my year. It was the last book I read in 2024. So yeah, that was good. That's all the books that I've read at this point. On to Kirakira, right? Yes. Sorry, the podcast muscles are a bit. I needed to stretch them, get them back. They've atrophied.
Atrophied.
I've not been to the gym in a while, you might say. Anyway, Rebecca, I believe you're talking about the author of this book.
Let's talk about Cynthia. So Cynthia has a very slim Wikipedia page, but her author website is really beautiful and enlightening. So I encourage you to go to that if you want to know more about her. She was born in Chicago in 1956, but she moved to Georgia before she could talk. Both of her parents were born in California, and to quote her, she said that they had impoverished childhoods and later really rewarding lives. Her father was drafted into military service out of an internment camp in Arkansas, where he was incarcerated because
of his race. Can you imagine that? Like, the country that imprisoned you takes you out of the prison camp to be conscripted into the army?
And that's your way out. You know, that's your way. It's
unbelievable. It's truly unbelievable.
So she talked about that in his, on her page about like her dad's way forward. She said that she likes to write about children and sometimes animals who encounter hardship but manage to find their path forward, and that children finding their path forward is her obsession. So you'll see that theme throughout her books, especially in the one that we're going to talk about today. She has an older sister and a younger brother, also very similar to the character in this book. And she says she felt quite beloved growing up, which is a beautiful thing. She lived in Chicago, Georgia, Arkansas, and California as a child. And she has said that Springdale, Arkansas is where she feels her most essential character was formed. Her father was a chicken sexer, just like the father in this book, and would work really long hours. But she told this beautiful story that when he was working, her mother would sit with her and her siblings in the backyard and point out the constellations and discuss the mythology behind them. And that's when she learned how big the world was beyond her town. And she said that she developed a yearning in her soul for what she didn't know. As an adult, she lived in Boston and Southern California, which is where she currently lives, according to her author bio. She got her BA in journalism from the University of Southern California and attended graduate programs at the University of Pittsburgh and Columbia. When she was younger, she attended a lot of schools and also dropped out of some. She dropped out of her high school, and she encouraged people in her bio that there's no single path forward. You might be a straight-A student or drop out of high school, and you might both still attend an Ivy League like she did. So she first started writing after a bus ride where she visited her father and saw so much of the American landscape and met a lot of people along the way. And she felt a lot like she had when she was looking at the constellations in her backyard. She discovered contemporary fiction in Boston and decided to write a story every month that she sent out to magazines. And she said something about viewing the constellations night after night gives you the courage later in life to take a leap of faith, even though the world keeps rejecting you, which I thought was a beautiful little bit of insight. She was first published in The New Yorker with a short story in 1986.
Man, imagine that being your first publication in The New Yorker. That's pretty.
I know.
That's pretty cool.
She has since published 10 books for children and 3 for adults. And in addition to the 2005 Newbery Medal for Kira Kira, she also won the 2013 National Book Award for The Thing About Luck. She loves dogs, especially Dobermans. So if you go to her bio page, she says this is also Wilson's page. Wilson is her dog. And she at one point, if not now, because I don't think this has been updated in a long time, was the team manager for her son's youth hockey team.
Wow.
So there's her life.
Cool.
Yeah.
Honestly, I would like to know more about her dad because that seems most relevant to the book plot that I'm about to describe. So it's my turn to talk about the plot. So Kira Kira is about a family, and it never exactly says the time period exactly, but like it's not the internment camp. It's not during World War II because their family is not interred in a concentration camp. I think at one point they mentioned Eisenhower being the president. So I think it's supposed to be like the 1950s or something like that. But it's that time period. It's like mid-century America. And it focuses on this Japanese-American family. And they start the book in Iowa, but they hear about work down in Georgia. And so work at a chicken hatchery. So they move away from all the people that they know in Iowa and go to Georgia. And most of the plot of the book is them adjusting to their new life in Georgia. And specifically, so they have 3 kids. So there's the youngest son,
Sammy,
who doesn't really get a lot to do in the book, to be honest. Why'd you give me that face?
Well, there's a pretty big scene with him involved, but continue.
Yeah, but he's not the focus of the book. Like, the big focus of the book is on the other 2 daughters, who are, Lynn is the oldest daughter, oldest child in general, and then the middle child is our narrator, because it's a first-person book, and her name is Katie. And basically, most of the book follows Lynn and Katie trying to get established it's like rural Georgia, too. Like, they're not in anywhere that I recognize about Georgia. It seems to be a community entirely centered around, like, this chicken hatchery owned by this kind of, like, baron kind of figure.
I kind of pictured him as Colonel Sanders, you know?
Yeah, he's got, like, a big, like, southern, you know, probably if this were set 100 years earlier in the past, he would have owned a plantation or something. Like, because everyone around seems very poor. And they all seem to work for this chicken guy. And there's just him being the super rich guy there. Katie, the protagonist and narrator, struggles to fit in. She struggles with school. Whereas Lynn kind of immediately finds what seems to be her niche. She gets like a friend named Amber. And they kind of seem to hit it off. Lynn is like a star student at the school. But Lynn is very much like a mentor to Katie, and Katie looks up to Lynn. Meanwhile, like both of their parents are working. In fact, the father is working multiple jobs, both as a sexer and then like also like a sexer at 2 different locations. Right? Am I remembering this correctly?
So.
Their parents are basically working themselves to the bone with the ambition of one day, like, buying a house and owning it so that they can be a bit more stable and they can have a nice place to live. Meanwhile, Lynn is starting to have some health problems that are also increasingly taking up the time and energy of the family. But also because the parents are working so much, a lot of the taking care of Lynn when Lynn is... you know, having one of her, like, bouts is kind of put on Katie, who is like increasingly the kind of glue that's holding the family together, even though she doesn't feel like equipped
to do so. And she's also doing caretaking for her younger brother, correct, Sammy, yes, at the same time.
So anyway, I don't know how much we want to spoil. I mean, there's little subplots. Like, for instance, there's a unionization subplot at the Chicken Hatchery. Initially, Katie's mom is against unionization because she just wants to have the job. She doesn't want anything that's going to jeopardize the job. Eventually Katie gets to be friends with some families who are pro-union. So there's, like, that going on. There's also, like the ongoing plot with, like, Lynn's illness. There is also kind of, like, upsetting little bit where, I think this is probably what you're referring to, where Sammy gets, like, caught in an animal trap that the rich dude, what is his name, Mr. Linden, that Mr. Linden has, Mr. Linden, like, sets animal traps around, and they're, like, going on a picnic or something, the girls and Sammy are, and Sammy gets caught in a, sounds like a bear trap or something like that, and, So there's, like, that plot, and, like, the family gets really mad at Mr. Linden and, like, vandalizes property, and so that's, like, another subplot. And it eventually works out to be a very sad book. And, I mean, we can spoil the ending a little bit later, I guess.
Mm-hmm. We probably will. There's also an uncle, her dad's
that's
brother.
That's right. That's the whole reason that they moved down there is because the uncle is the one who's told them about work. And so a lot of times, when the parents are working, it's the uncle and his family that is kind of like looking over the rest of the kids. Mm-hmm. Right. And this uncle seems to be a lot more like loosey goosey and you might say irresponsible. Definitely like, he's like a fun uncle at times, but then also like gets him into some scrapes.
He also strikes me as this uncle that like, everybody but the dad is always annoyed by. Like, the dad's like, no, that's my brother. Like,
yeah.
He's
well, that's kind of like the defining characteristic of the dad is that, like, this dad is really long suffering and, like, seems to truly only care about, like, working hard to, like, help his family. Mm-hmm. And so, he seems, like, really kind of unflappable at times. Or maybe you could say, like, nonchalant, even in occasions where he should be more chalant. You might say, but yeah, I mean, that's kind of the plot. It's very slice of life. It's very, you know, kind of, coming of age, like historical fiction, semi, I guess not autobiographical, but since the author herself is not in this specific situation, but definitely taken from her family history.
Yeah, I think you're right. Her sister was still alive in adulthood, so I don't think that, there's a spoiler.
So Lynn eventually dies.
Of cancer.
It's like leukemia, right, or lymphoma or something like that. Yeah. It's really horrible, and so, like, the last, like, maybe quarter of the book or something is after she's died and, like, them, like, dealing with the grief and all that, which ends up being, like, fairly messy and ends up being kind of unresolved by the end. Like, it is kind of, like, Missing May in a little, in a sense, like, where it's more about the process of grief than about the resolution of grief by the end.
Yeah, and I do think it's really interesting that, like, Cynthia was a middle child and mirrors a lot, from what I can tell, mirrors a lot of Katie's, like, plot in this book. Like, she struggles in school. She, you know, sometimes works really hard and applies herself, and then sometimes that's a lot harder. And so, anyway, and just making the main character have an older sister and a younger brother and a dad who works in a hatchery, I would be interested in hearing, like, her perspective on how much of this is from your childhood and how much of this is, like, from stories of people that you met, you know, and experience, and how much of this is just from your imagination. So, all of that's really fascinating to me.
You're kind of already on this, but what did you like about the book, Rebecca?
I am a sucker for a story about some sisters, okay? I just love a story about relationships between sisters. I think that's why I loved Jacob Have I Loved so much. I think that's why I love Little Women so much. So I really, one of my favorite parts of this book was the relationship between the sisters, even in the hard times. And just knowing what that's like to love someone so much and be so frustrated with them at the same time. And I think that Cynthia captures that tension really well. I also love this scene. I love the dad in general. I just love him. But there's this subplot where the dad is so frustrated. His oldest daughter has died. He did everything he could to save her. They've gone into basically financial ruin just with her medical bills. And his son has been hurt with this trap in this rich man's fields. And the rich man is his employer and is his wife's employer. And so all of that comes to a head. And he has Katie take him to the field where he found the trap. And he picks up the trap. And then they drive to Mr. Linden's mansion and, he busts up his car or something like
this
that.
This happens after she's died?
Doesn't it? Or is it... it's not.
He goes and talks to Mr. Linden about it after she's died, I think.
Okay. Well, at some point in the book, he does this. I think it is before her death. But, anyway, as he's, like... Katie makes some kind of comment about that after her sister dies. And it's like her dad realizes, this is never said, but it's like he realizes that he may not be able to save his daughter or get his family out of poverty, but he can teach his daughter about, like, what it means to have character and to take responsibility for your actions and to not let other people dictate, like, your future and your path forward, which is what Cynthia's big thing is. And so he then goes to Mr. Linden and apologizes for what he did, and Mr. Linden is completely ungracious and awful, just as anyone would expect him to be. And then also says, you'll hear from my lawyers. But to Katie's dad, it was more important for him to, like, teach her, like, hey, this is not actually the way that we want to be and live in the world. There's another path forward, and this is not the one I want for you. And so that scene was really, like, hard to read, but I did love it at the same time. I also really like the relationship between Katie and her uncle has become one of my favorite things in this book, because in the beginning, she's really just complaining about how loud he is and how annoying he is. There's this terrible scene when they're camping and he, like, almost drives the car off a cliff and needs Katie to help drive in order to get it off the cliff. Just puts this terrible responsibility on these kids that is just, like, not good. So she's constantly annoyed with him. He's constantly annoyed with her. But, like, after her sister has died, she's just grieving about, like, this moment of unkindness that she displayed toward her. And he just comes to her and he comforts her over her guilt and about her unkindness. And he tells her that Katie never hated Lynn. And when people are dying, you just get crazy thoughts. And that doesn't mean that your relationship wasn't one of love or that Lynn didn't feel that. It was just this really beautiful scene of, like, seeing this vulnerability from him and seeing the care that he has for his nieces. And I just thought it was a pretty thing. So this book is full of, like, little scenes like that I really liked. What did you like?
I mean, I liked all that too. And it's the kind of book where it is mostly, like, little scenes that you gravitate toward. It's not like, obviously, there's an overarching plot like we talked about, but it really thrives on those little small moments. And a moment that you didn't describe, but that you kind of described the aftermath of, that I thought was really good, is the way there's, like, a few scenes, and one scene in particular where, like, Katie becomes really resentful of Lynn, because when Lynn's sick, it's mostly Katie who has to, like, directly care for her during the times when her parents are gone. And Lynn being sick is kind of out of sorts and is not treating her well and doesn't always seem to know what it is that's going to make her feel better anyway. And so, like, there's this one scene where Katie just, like, gets, like, furious with Lynn over something that Lynn does is not very nice, but also, like, Lynn's sick and, like, not really in a clear state of mind either. But like Katie like thinks about like how much she hates her and doesn't want her to be around and like all that sort of stuff. And just like making space for that sort of thing in a book like this, I think is making space for something like that in a book like this is really tough. You know, a lot of times when we think about children dying, we want to think about them being kind of like angelic. And the fact that like the texture of her death is not merely this one of this like innocent child dying. It's like deeply complicated, and the people involved obviously don't want her to die, but it's not pure sadness. Like there's all these other emotions that are like satellite emotions to that, where, you know, in addition to the grief, there's like deep frustration and anger and all this stuff that's like really complicated. And I think that the book deals with it really well and deals with it really generously as well. Like no one is like, it's all presented very non-judgmentally. Like the book is not obviously criticizing Lynn for being, you know, difficult to care for. You know, I mean, that would be horrible if it did that. But it's also like, you know, very generous toward like the way that like Katie responds to it as well. And the way that like if you were Katie's age, which is like, what's she like 10 at this time or something like that? You know, if you were 10, like there's a whole spectrum of feelings and ways that you would react to your sibling dying and you having to take care of your sibling as she dies. That I think is really nuanced. And I think a lot of the book is like that, where it's putting a lot of different things in concert with one another. Like the unionization thing, like, you know, the way that it allows like her mother to say like, no, the unionization is bad because it jeopardizes her jobs. And like, we understand why she would say that, but we're also given like, the book is generous enough to give us the position of like the people who are trying to unionize, and you see the ways that they make connections with each other by just by virtue of being in the same job and caring for one another. But you also see the ways that there is friction, you know, like, I think it's when they come to Lynn's funeral, this other family who's the pro-union family wears their union pins to the funeral. And that's kind of like, you know, it's like a little bit of grit in that moment where they're showing up for these other, this other family, but like the conflict between them is still there. And I think that the book just does a good job in like, identifying those moments where, you can like where it can identify, these kind of complicated intersections of emotions. And I think that like taken as a whole, like the arc of the book is not like groundbreaking. But like the way that it does these individual scenes is really well done.
Yeah.
And I like that about the book.
Yeah. I think that's good.
What'd you dislike?
Well, I feel like this is kind of like counteracting what you just said. And that's why I like doing this podcast with you, because I think sometimes you help me see things that...
Sometimes I'm right and you're wrong.
No, that's not what I meant. But I do think like, you know, just reading anything with somebody is like opens up other perspectives about it, which I think is healthy. But I just felt like the prose kind of fell flat to me. And it just seemed like the plot didn't always have a really interesting flow. So it wasn't like hard for me to read. It's a very like easy to read book, but sometimes it's like, it feels like this happened and this happened and then this happened. There were parts where I felt like something awful was about to happen, the way that she was telling the story, and then it wouldn't. So I was really caught off guard when Sammy got caught in the trap, because I felt like most of her book was building up to like something awful like that happening, just in the way she was telling the story. So I had just got used to being like, oh no, she's just describing life. Like nothing awful is about to happen. She's just describing life. And then when that happened, it just kind of like took me off guard, but I still think that was a really good scene. So anyway, those are really my only critiques.
Yeah, I will say like the prose is not like, it's not memorable. I don't remember turns of phrases and stuff like that. It's always kind of hard when you're dealing with like first person narrators who are children, you know, unless you're going to do something experimental that's like you know, really getting inside the mind of a child, like in a William Faulkner-esque way or something like that. I guess I just don't know how an author would have a first-person protagonist that's a child and not make it just kind of like pedestrian prose. Because otherwise it would sound like someone who's not a child.
Right.
But I do agree on that. I also feel like that, and I mean, this is just like the nature of like the kind of book that this is, but like it takes a while for it to get going because, like I said, there's not like a huge like forward push with the plot. You're getting just kind of like scene by scene, and you're like developing the texture of like, what is this life like? And so like for a while, he like moved to Georgia and they're working in the chicken hatchery and stuff like that. And I didn't find it boring at the beginning exactly, but I was kind of like, okay, where is this going? And it kind of takes a while for like some of that stuff to kind of settle in as far as like, okay, these are the threads that we're following going forward. And I don't know if that's exactly like a flaw in the book, but like I was definitely much more engaged by the end than I was at the beginning.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, do you have any other thoughts on this book before we give our thumbs?
No.
What do you give this?
A thumbs up.
I also give it a thumbs up. I also thought it's just really moving, like, by the end. It's super sad. Rebecca and I were talking about, it's kind of like a subgenre of children's literature where it's just, like, someone dying. And that's kind of the, like, if I had to guess, like, that's one of the reasons why a book like this gets picked for the Newbery Medal is that it has a really, you know, impactful death in it.
So one of my friends, Marsha, who's a faithful listener of this podcast and has been anxiously waiting for us to finish this she read this like months ago, was just like talking with me at church about this and like we were asking the question of, why is so much of children's literature, like these award-winning books, why are they all sad? And so Michael and I were talking about that, and I don't know for sure, except that, like, I've always loved sad stories. And I think part of it is that it's a great way to show strong emotions. I think when you can tell a strong, like, tell a sad story well. And I think also, I think so many of us as adults don't know how to process these things ourselves, but especially like the question is always, how do I talk about this with a child? How do I feel these big emotions with a child? What's going to be helpful to them and not damaging? How much of this am I vulnerable about and how much do I keep to myself until they're older? And so I wonder, you know, obviously these awards are being given by adults. So I wonder if there is this desire to like award these books that captured these feelings and emotions that are so hard for us to explain to children. And when we find a book that we feel like can do this well with a child, maybe we gravitate toward those. I don't know. That's just a theory that I have.
I also think that there's been kind of different types of stories. Like doing this podcast has shown me like different types of stories and different types of engagement with difficult material has kind of ebbed and flowed. Like there's been like different schools of thought. Like, if you think about something like The Miracle on Maple Hill, that is a book that's dealing with kind of difficult material, but is doing it in a way that's a lot more pat and less raw than, like, something like Kira Kira or even Missing May, or to name, like, a couple other books that deal with, like, other hard material like The Bridge to Terabithia or, like, I don't think Where the Red Fern Grows is a Newbery Medal winning book, but that's another book that, like,
represents...
It represents kind of like that, I guess, like later, like once you get into the 60s and 70s onward, like there's a real, there seems to be a value of kind of being able to take difficult emotions and convey them to children in a way that is also not patronizing or sanding off edges for children. Whereas if you go a bit earlier in children's literature, it's kind of the opposite where there seems to be a real value in taking difficult things, but then making lessons that are a bit more easily compartmentalized or lessons that are a bit more easily giving answers to these kind of difficult things. But then maybe, again, not like, what was that book that we read where that woman gets randomly murdered and they don't really talk about it?
Oh, roller skates, right?
Roller skates, right? Like, some of the books do have just some random, like, really difficult, like, scary stuff in them that doesn't get really, you know, dealt with. So maybe I'm wrong about, you know, acting like there's, like, a different schools of thought that take control of, like, how these awards mm-hmm. work or not. But
anyway, we're interested to hear your theory about that. Like, if you're one that engages with the podcast, email us, tell us your thoughts. I'd love to talk about this more.
Yeah, for sure. As a
podcast community.
My one last thought, which I said to Rebecca, is that I think also there's not that many of these that are actually sad. It's just the ones that are sad stand out.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe...
And people talk about
them more. People talk about them more. So those are the ones that people... end up reading in, like, school and that sort of thing.
You say that, and we've done two death books in a row.
Yeah, but I think that that's also, like, an accident. you know, like, Shiloh, for instance, is a 90s book. That's not sad, really.
I think it's sad.
But it's not, like, sad in the way that, like, these last two books have been sad.
Maybe.
And I guess, so maybe there's a higher... concentration of sadness in, like, the Newbery Medals, but overall, like, I would say that, like, if you're throwing a stick, you're more likely to hit a book that's not sad than is sad. I don't know.
Maybe.
That's just shooting from the hip, my feelings. But I'm also reading stuff like James and the Say Hello to My Little Friend, both of which are, like, kind of have these horrible violent ends. So,
yeah.
I don't know. So. Thumbs up for both of us, right?
Definitely.
All right, so next time, and hopefully, you know, never mind. I'm not going to say any hopes. We make no promises about when the next one will come out. But when we do record again, we will be in the 2010s again. We are going to read the 2013 Newbery Medal winner. It's called The One and Only Ivan, and it's by Catherine Applegate. So yeah, that's what we'll be reading. Also, if you'd like to email us, tell Rebecca your thoughts about sad books, or weigh in for children, or weigh in on anything else that we've talked about, you can email us at newberrychronicles@gmail.com, and you'll probably get a response from us if everything is going well. If you don't get a response from us, probably we won't be doing the podcast for a while, but we intend to respond eventually. You got any more thoughts, Rebecca?
No.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll talk next time. Bye.